Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema for your free 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. Gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and joining me on this expedition into cinematic discussion, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And Michael Snydell.
Hello.
Hello. Today, we will be talking about the newest film from writer-director James Gray, that is The Lost City of Z. And this, of course, is based on the book that was written by David Gran, which was based on a true story. So we'll have a lot to talk about, and hopefully I'm not the only one who did some background research to add to the discussion.
Less than I'd like. A bit.
Just a bit. Okay, well, good enough. So that's on the docket for today. Nothing else. Before we get into it, let me remind everyone that you can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. Of course, you can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And we always love to get comments and ratings on iTunes. We actually got a couple this past week. First comes from Dustin Eisman. It says, a film podcast for true cinephiles. One of the only film podcasts with true film criticism that's also accessible. Anytime the hosts love or hate a particular film, the reviews always come across even-handed, which is news to me, so that's good. This one by Darth Quark is just that shrug emoji, but it's 5 stars, and it says pretty good. Could use a larger cast or more guest hosts, though. From experience, I could say that a cast of more than 3 usually gets very unwieldy, but we could and are hoping to get guest hosts. The final one is from Hauk Fivodk Acid? I don't know.
Wow.
But the title is Awesome Show, and it says, I look forward to the new episodes and roundtables every week. The show is super entertaining, funny, and insightful. All things that I do feel comfortable agreeing with. So, those are the reviews we got. I also looked up, we have reviews on foreign iTunes sites, but from context clues, it seems as though they might be super, super old. So I'm not going to read them. But Great Britain, Australia, and Canada all have given us 5-star reviews. Actually, the one from Great Britain was 1 star because apparently someone on this podcast said that games were not art. And that person decided to unsubscribe from us and they gave us a 1-star review.
Someone said games are not art?
Look, it wasn't me.
I strongly disagree with that.
Yeah, so if that person hate listens to us still, know that at some point, whoever said that probably left this podcast.
I'm very sad. I don't want that opinion to be associated with our podcast.
Well, it's just one guy in Great Britain who feels that way. I literally don't remember that.
Come back.
We should make a motion about that. We no longer feel that
I can tell
that
this is deeply affecting Mike, which is kind of funny to me anyway. But anyway, that's that. We are brought to you today by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Mubi is a great collection of foreign, independent, and all-around wonderful films that is actually selected by curators and presented one film at a time. So every day a new film is introduced, you have 30 days to watch, and then it disappears. So you have a rotating selection of 30 films, a bunch of new stuff coming to Mubi. For instance, Mubi is partnered with the Locarno Film Festival in LA, And so they have two highlights from that festival: The Idea of a Lake, which I am intrigued by just by the title, and All the Cities of the North, which is less intriguing of a title than The Idea of a Lake, but I'm assuming since it's on Mubi, it's probably great.
Why and do you Mubi, hate the North, Brian?
I don't know, because I live in the North, technically. No, I don't. Do I?
I'm more north than you.
I am below the Mason-Dixon line, but I am north of D.C., and Maryland was not allowed to secede from the Union. Lincoln put federal troops in our state capital to keep that from happening. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm in the North.
Fair enough.
Yeah, when I go to New York, people call me a Southerner. And when I go down to Texas, I get called a Yankee. So I'm really just like some sort of strange mutt that nobody cares to love. Anyway, moving on. You can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. And, of course, you can watch Mubi on your mobile devices, your personal computer, and Roku's top sets, where they have a beautiful, beautiful app. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. Gentlemen, any other things to discuss before we get into our feature review today?
No,
I don't believe so.
All right, excellent. Then here, my friends, is the trailer for The Lost City of Z, which again is directed by James Gray and stars Charlie Hunnam, Robert Pattinson, Tom Holland, and we cannot neglect to mention Sienna Miller.
You are the explorer? Give me a hand. Don't be afraid. You dream to be in a forest.
I wish to find a lost city.
What you seek is far greater than you ever imagined. Your soul will never be quiet until you find this place. It is your destiny.
There's a major exploration afoot.
Terrible disease, murderous savages. The journey may well mean your life.
Don't go.
All right, that is the trailer for The Lost City of Z. This is the newest film from writer-director James Gray, who previously was featured on this podcast when we talked about The Immigrant, lo, those many years ago. This particular film is based on a nonfiction novel by David Gran, who wrote for The New Yorker, and that itself was based on the true story of British explorer Percival Fawcett, who spent a lot of time in Amazonia charting and exploring under the belief that somewhere there was a lost city, which he codenamed Zed. I am just going to begin by saying I am going to try my damnedest to remember to call it Zed, but anytime that I am reading the title or glance at the title before speaking the title, I may slip up and say Z.
Same here.
Yeah, but the movie, it's never called Z. It's always Zed. I don't understand the English language, in all honesty. So let's talk about it. Let's see what we all thought of The Lost City of Z. Let's start with Michael Snydell.
All right. So The Lost City of Z's,
Zed.
I guess
Damn
we
it.
Haven't really.
Did I do it again? I did it already?
Yeah. If you would have let me finish my sentence, Brian, The Lost City of Zed.
Son of a bitch. Oh, man.
Okay.
That's
so,
it. We're starting it all over again.
This is the latest film from James Gray, who is a director that especially some critics hold in extremely high esteem. And his films do get, you know, fairly good reviews in the sense that people who rate him positively think he makes masterpieces. Like The Immigrant, like, infamously did not actually even release in Europe because I believe it was Robbie Collins at the Telegraph gave it such a negative review at the time its festival. So he's definitely, it feels weird to call him divisive when the people who like him think he's one of our, you know, greatest contemporary filmmakers, but it's worth bringing that up right away, because as far as sheer craft, Gray's kind of peerless these days. I mean, when it comes to production design and his visual ambitions in terms of the scope of the images he chooses to compose, like, there's a reason why he's, put in conversation, with a lot of directors who've only made epics. Like, even when his films are small scale, they just have such an incredible force to them. Now, with that said, I'm very much a Gray agnostic. I didn't really like The Immigrant, and Wheel in the Night is my other experience. And but the reason I go through all of this is because Lost City of Z is another film where the people who love it really, really love it, and the people who don't find it kind of inert and find it to be kind of a series of, in the case of The Immigrant, they called it a series of dioramas, and in this case, it's in a jungle, so dioramas doesn't really feel accurate. But what I like about this film is that it feels very alive, and not necessarily in terms of the characterizations and the dialogue, but in terms of the structure and the framing and the pacing. This movie, like, very much earns, like, its comparisons to novels, and in the sense it just, in the way it deals with, like, time alone, in the sense that years and years can go by where this whole time the main character just is, just has a yearning to search for this city, and, like, that is just put on hold repeatedly. And so what I find so interesting about this film is it is at once, this character's search for transcendence, but also this really interesting look at, like, cultural anthropology and the way that even those who seem like the most enlightened, which is fascinating for reasons we'll get into later related to the real Fawcett, it's just constantly mutating, and that's why I want to like it more than I do. I think it's an incredibly beautiful movie, and I think that the performances and what's going on, I don't think the detractors are giving it quite enough credit, but I can't get behind this effusive praise, because I don't think that this film earns the really grandiose climax that it eventually gets into. And I'm still not really sure. It feels like a have a cake and eat it moment for me in terms of tone, of where this film goes and how it wants to at once be like commentary, but also be this adventure, and not really reconcile those two qualities. So I'm sounding, as usual, I am rambling. And this is a very strange film, so I guess that's understandable. It's at times a really good film. There's the performances are a good. Pattinson is fantastic in here. It's just this really tart, a comrade who is always around and just has a great one-liners. And Charlie Hunnam is really interesting. It's just, just playing on his reputation as just this, like, very regal, very, like, blandly regal actor. Like, this movie plays on those things really well, but I'm not sure at a certain point whether I'm projecting this slyness and whether I just don't really want what this movie's actually selling, which is eventually a more traditional search for meaning. So again, I really like parts of this movie, but it just didn't really ever it always kept me at arm's length.
Okay. Bill Graham, what did you think of The Lost City of Zed?
So I think I want to start this conversation off by just asking a general question. Who here has either who here has actually read the book?
I have
besides
not.
Myself.
I have not.
Okay. So I've read the book, and the book is a hell of a journey. It's a hell of a tale. And one thing that it makes painfully clear, either through Fawcett's journeys or the several people after him, is that the Amazon is not a place for humans, or at least Westerners, people from outside of the outside of that area. It's
not for dilettantes.
Yes, a bunch of white people coming down there not exactly gonna work too well. And I feel like that is one shortcoming that this film really has, is that there's a certain amount of danger because it's a jungle, period. And there's a certain amount of danger because of the locals. But beyond that, there's just not a lot of terror to be had from the jungle itself. And I feel like that's a huge, huge missed opportunity, because if you've read the book, it is a hell of a tale. All the adventures that go down there, whether they're before or after Fawcett, it is an incredibly oppressive location. If you can imagine, it's constantly sweltering hot. It modifies from raining to not raining, so everything is constantly wet or moist or just about to deteriorate. Clothing just comes to shreds, and that's not to include the wildlife. The wildlife is constantly oppressive as well. All of this is to say that my hesitation here is to pull in too much from what I know from the book versus what I know from the film and what the film was giving me. I try to be constantly aware of that, and I'm hypersensitive to anyone that takes too much criticism and levies it at a film adaptation and says, well, this is what they did wrong, this is what they did right, and comes at it from a standpoint of whether they got certain things factually correct or whether they got the feeling or tone. I like to try and judge the piece on what it did and what it's doing. And I think in that sense, James Gray, I've listened to a couple of interviews with him already, and he will be one of the first to say that maybe he took a little bit too much liberty with some of the things that he's did in this film. I think Fawcett comes off as a hero in this film, and I think it's interesting the way that it's kind of set up to make him this kind of glamorous person, whether it's casting someone that is as good looking as Hunnam is, and putting him in this role. I think it's the most interesting thing is that I pulled away from this film is the way it was shot, the way it was put together. James Gray really, really sells this idea of this kind of high stakes adventure, and it's quite enjoyable to look at. It's a beautiful film, and the acting performances from Hunnam, who does a really, really good job of selling this character's kind of desire, like constant desire to return to this location, and he can't quite put his thumb on why. There's just something that draws him to it. And I really enjoyed Pattinson, and Sienna Miller probably has the standout role for me throughout the film. I think she does incredible work for a role that is very much underserved by the movie, by the script, everything like that. And she is really, really putting in some strong work here on the sidelines.
Hey, Bill, I know you said that you want to separate the book and movie experience, but since you are the one who has read the book, I mean, the major one that I've seen news stories about is that he's kind of a hardcore racist in the book, is what I understand.
I don't remember the hardcore racism as much. What I remember is it's a little bit of the in between. It's a little bit of he had some racial ideas, as did a lot of people that he was kind of working with in the film. You know, that's a very, very clear situation that is happening, where when he comes with this idea that there's a city, that there's some kind of culture,
actual civilization.
Yeah, a culture that they have. A lot of the people, British people, scoff at that general idea, and whether it's because of eugenics or whether it's because of, you know, all of these just white nationalism and all of this stuff. He even kind of brings in the Bible during one of the speeches in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, whoa, you are treading down a path that I didn't realize you felt strongly about, until, you know, you found what you believe is evidence of that, you know. So yeah, in the book, it's, man, I read that book probably in 2010, 2011, shortly after it came out. So my memory of it, of all the small details, are you know, fairly hazy. If you've listened to this podcast, and my co-hosts will understand when I say my memory is not the greatest. So you know, you asked me about a book that came out 6 years ago, 7 years sure. ago, and it's like, whoa, I don't remember specifics that much. I do remember that Fawcett was not painted as the hero that he is here. So it's an interesting diversion, almost against reality.
I think it super interesting that people – he is the hero of the movie, but I don't think he's particularly painted as a hero.
I would agree with Brian with this. I don't know. I go back and forth on that.
Well, he certainly comes off better than much of reality would kind of paint his character to be. Mm-hmm. The way he treats some of his companions in this film are pretty nice. The way he actually treated much of his companions were like not very nice at all. You know, they were basically there to service his expedition, and that was it. Whether they died, whether they lived, it wasn't much of his concern. So, you know, they give him a little bit more.
I mean, I'll be honest, like, in this movie, there are times when you forget that there are other people in his expedition, because he is so thoroughly willing to leave them behind and not give a shit about them.
Like, yeah, at times.
Like, I think that it's really interesting that there's some scenes too that, you know, like I guess the exact scene you're talking about where he invokes the Bible, and like the camera just like slowly, like floats, and I shouldn't say pan. Whatever, pans over this huge group of people, you know, who are laughing at his belief that like natives can be, you know, have their own civilization. Mm-hmm. But like, mm-hmm. I felt like that has a slyness to it. Like I feel like Gray kind of also thinks that Fawcett's kind of a self-righteous twit as well. Like I like he, like, that's the weird thing about it. Like, I think Gray is deeply moved by his search for meaning, but I also think at times he kind of thinks Fawcett's kind of an idiot. Like, it's this weird combination that I think is kind of, I guess, lost in the third act for me. So that's why it feels a little bit weird to me. Like, I feel like the movie kind of stops negotiating itself and decides at the end that it just wants to be completely serious. But I mean, I can completely understand an argument the other way, but I was curious what you guys specifically felt about that.
Well, it's hard for me to, I haven't done my full basic thoughts yet. Michael, what is the most succinct way you can rephrase that question to help me lead into that?
Sure. You know what, whatever. Why do you think that this movie doesn't make him or why do you think it's ambiguous that he's heroic?
Okay. Bill, do you have any final larger thoughts to wrap up before I just flop in here and take up what's left of the oxygen?
I mean, I think we can lead into your review and then just open it up for kind of a general discussion.
As we do. These like,
yeah, sorry guys, I'm probably a little early with this stuff.
Yeah, these general thought statements always take so much longer than I expect them to. Cuz I always expect, like, okay, everyone will do 5 minutes and just say what they thought of the movie. And here we are 26 minutes into the recording. And I still haven't technically done that yet.
Shit.
Yeah, assholes. So, Lost City of Z. I loved this movie. This is currently sitting at my number 2 film of the year, just beneath Terrence Malick's Song to Song, because that's just who I am. And I have to say that everything from the cinematography to the score to the acting to the editing to the sweep of it is just old school, this is why you go to the movies type filmmaking. I mean, it's almost like stepping into a repertory screening of something that you didn't know got made in the 60s or 70s.
Sure,
you know, and I'm so lucky, allow me a moment to plug a theater by me. AFI Silver in Silver Spring, just outside of Washington, is a movie theater. It's got 3 screens. 2 of them are small. But one of them is like old school Movie Palace. It's a rehabbed Movie Palace from back in the day. So I got,
is it dual double decker?
No, it is not. Okay. That would be awesome. They just opened up one of those in Baltimore, but it has an absurd name and I can't remember the name of it, but it's the centerpiece of the Maryland Film Festival, which will be going on soon. But anyway,
nice.
So AFI Silver, you sit down and it's this massive screen. It's got like the beautiful curtains in front of it. And then they open and, I mean, like, that's just the place to watch this movie. Like, I can't imagine going to one of the multiplexes and seeing this film, because this film feels made of a time when movies had something else, like that magic that people talk about that people don't understand if they've only ever seen the Fast and the Furious movies or the Marvel films. Like, not that those aren't worthwhile and they don't benefit from the big screen, because they do. Oh my God. I can't imagine never having seen like Fast and Furious 6 on the big screen. But there is when we talk about, you know, movies as a religious experience and the theater as a temple, like, this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. It's not big for the sake of the action. It's big for the sake of the vision. And that's what this movie has. And not only that, but I think it's an interesting story. And as I've read more about it, obviously people are going to take from this film what they take from it. I didn't take that he was a hero. I took that he was a man with a very limited vision, a very limited set of opportunities, which we can talk about. And this became something else for him. It's not that he was trying to prove something or like, he's not doing this to try to earn better treatment for the people of the Amazon. He's doing this because it's something that no one believes, and it's something that he wants to be able to prove to them. It's this idea that's gotten into his brain and he's certain of it, and he just needs to find the pieces that are necessary to make other people believe him.
literal pieces.
Yeah. Well, he has those tiny pieces. He just needs much bigger pieces.
Yes.
And it's just super interesting how, like, I didn't know what to expect when I went into this movie. I never saw the trailers. I never read the book. I didn't even know the book was based on a true story. Like, when the title cards came up at the end of this, I was a little shocked. I was like, oh, shit. This is a real guy.
Say that again?
I never read the book. I didn't know the book was based on a true story.
Whoa.
I just didn't, man. I didn't know much about this book. And to be completely honest with you, The Lost City of Zed... The Lost City of Zed doesn't strike me as an interesting title. It sounds super B movie. It sounds real, like Treasure Island, you know? And I don't think that Treasure Island's real, so why would I want
to Journey to the Center of the Earth?
Yeah, exactly. But that pulpiness of the title kind of plays in to like the light pulp. It's like this guy is just going after his own myth. Because he himself wants to become part of it. And it's interesting. You know, I thought that this would be a whole movie of just guy in the jungle, you know, real Aguirre Wrath of God stuff. But instead, you know, it's him constantly dipping back into the jungle for as long as fate and time will allow him, and then getting yanked back out. And there's something truly meaningful and universal about that, about having that moment where you feel like you're where you're supposed to be and then circumstances conspiring to take you out of it.
And also what you sacrifice in the process of that.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, I was taken in by this movie. I was swept up in it. And I'll be honest, any movie that involves a piranha attack scene, that's going to get 5 stars. There's just no way around that. When I was a kid, my wife and I were talking the other day about like things we were afraid of as children. And I said, all of my fears are like the most localized, specific, and legendary fears that I should never have been afraid of. So it was quicksand, piranhas, and Africanized honeybees, like killer bees.
Fuck,
right. So like as a kid, I'm like looking in a pool and I'm like, ooh, piranhas. And like I see one honeybee and I'm like, ooh, killer bees. I'm walking through the forest and I'm like, oh man, I'm going to sink in some quicksand. Like, those are my fears. So if I get a movie that allows me to see one of those put on the screen, it makes me feel like I did when I was a kid and I was wandering through the woods. And if I found a brick that some asshole had probably just lobbed out of their car or had been dropped and kicked and, like, you know, some teenager had thrown because he was bored, I would think to myself, my God, there must be a whole house under here somewhere. And this movie appeals to that, like that desire to believe that there's something bigger out there. And that you just have to step around the right corner to find it. And, you know, we can get into this guy. I read a couple of articles that were trying to do that whole, oh, you think this guy's so great. Well, here, let me tear him down. And, like, he doesn't sound any worse particularly than any other, you know, white British explorer.
Yeah, I think the character assassination by a lot of people on him is a little overblown, because it's like, of the time, he found something, he went after it. It may not have been his original idea. It didn't necessarily line up with his original ideas, but he was at least curious enough to kind of open his mind and be like, well, maybe this is something.
And
you know?
one of the things that I kept reading was like, all these modern day explorers were like, I don't know why we laud this man. He never even discovered anything. And I was like, what, who cares? Like, why? Understandably, like, if you're going to make someone, like, if you're going to give someone a statue somewhere, sure. Like, you want them to discover something, but like in art, in film, if his unceasing desire to go out and take one step further than he did last time is the story you're telling, then he doesn't have to discover something. You know, he doesn't have to, you know, kill a snake and take it home and no one has ever seen that snake before. You know, there's this weird, you know, it's academia, which rightfully only really wants to celebrate people who have made a discovery or advanced something. But for people like me, sometimes it's enough to just know that there was someone out there who had no solid reason to ever go back out again, but they did. And the fact that it's presented in such an alluring aesthetic package is all the better.
Well, I on that same note, do you guys have any thoughts specifically about Sienna Miller's character being changed then and being changed into someone who is more, yeah, I mean, it's more feminist, I guess is the best way to describe it. As I understand it, as I understand it, again, I have not read the book. I understand she was both a minimal character in the book and she did not say things like, I want to come with you.
She had a very interesting life, but yeah, I was listening to, I think it was actually James Gray, and he was talking about her history specifically and how they had a courtship back then because that's what they did. They courted each other, and through his mother, Fawcett found out that she was not a virgin, and so he told her he could not marry her, and so the courtship ended. She married someone else. He died.
Really?
He died, and on his deathbed, he told her, you should go seek out Fawcett. That's the one you're meant to be with. And so she came back to him, and shortly thereafter, they got married.
That's super awesome.
Yeah.
I love that story. So, I would watch a prequel that was just that story.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. And so a lot of this kind of her character unfortunately got lost in the shuffle of the book, and it got lost in the shuffle kind of this movie. I think they do her again. I love her character in this film.
And how long did it take you to realize that it was Sienna Miller?
You asked me before we were doing this podcast.
I am earnestly interested to know.
It took me about halfway till I realized that the woman that I was looking at for half the film, I was like, oh yeah, that's Sienna Miller, isn't it? I was like, I don't recognize her at all. And so, yeah, I still have no idea what Sienna Miller apparently looks like because she changes from film to film. She unfortunately, oh my God, her film career is just peppered with these women that sit on the sidelines.
Sure.
And are just there to be the pretty supporting wife. I find it incredibly fascinating that
yeah, Judy Greer. It's the Judy Greer syndrome.
a slightly better in terms of screen time, Judy Greer.
Yeah.
She's got American Sniper, which, you know, that was kind of her thing. Mm-hmm. Foxcatcher, Stardust.
and isn't she in High Rise as well?
Yeah, she's in High Rise. I literally don't remember what she does in High Rise.
And Burnt.
Yeah, who wants to? We should do an episode on Burnt.
And she doesn't do much in G.I. Joe either. So
that's,
you know,
crazy. I had a thing with this movie. When I first started looking up stuff about, I guess I'll start this in two phases. First of all, I thought that for the story the movie was telling, it actually seemed to go out of its way to make more time for her. And I had no idea that in reality she didn't ask to go. I think that it makes perfect sense with the way that the character is portrayed here that she would.
Mm-hmm.
And I love her final scene where she talks about stuff and things we can get into. I think that she delivers great work there. And I think that,
but I think that's why they have that earlier scene that,
I mean, there's a lot of scenes in this where you can feel her kind of like straining against this stuff, this nonsense that she has to do when, like, again, all she wants to do is go out and either help her husband or take some steps into the green desert of her own. And so I didn't know, and learning about it now, it doesn't bother me. I think that it's good that they made time for that. And it actually helps. It's one of those great things where it helps to broaden and deepen everyone's story that she got that sliver of her own story. Everything in this movie seems to work in service of everything else in this movie. Without those scenes of her and the way she acts, we wouldn't understand, you know, how he can't open her letters because he knows that he's left her, and he's, even if she's saying nothing but good things, she is living a life without him, and how hard must it be to be gone for years?
Just to have that reminder.
Yeah. So it's like he wants the information, but he doesn't want to see her handwriting. He doesn't want to hear her voice. So he has Robert Pattinson read it. Robert Pattinson rocking a hell of a beard and doing great character work, which is nice to see. And I wrestled with this for a bit because we'll all recall that I had a lot of problems with American Honey because I thought that the film itself didn't do enough to reckon with the reality of people who do magazine sales door to door. Saying that out loud now, it seems ridiculous, but I apparently had strong feelings about it at the time.
And I think on Amazon Prime, yeah, go watch it.
I think that the difference between the two is that American Honey, like, really seemed to just be luxuriating in the lifestyle and wanting to observe. And this movie more obviously is trying to say something and tell a story in a certain way. And I think that it's that, like, I don't feel like you would show this to someone who you wanted to learn about Percy Fawcett. And so I feel like under that, you know, under the protective barrier of the aesthetic choices made and the, I won't say obviousness of the narrative, but like the clarity of the narrative message, it becomes a little easier to take those changes because you know that they're made in service of this idea that they're trying to get across. And
is that to say that you would show American Honey to someone that was wanting to explore what being a magazine salesperson is?
Oh, absolutely not. Because the movie, movie doesn't do that at all. Like I said, it's how you present yourself and what you're trying to plumb out of that story. And whereas I felt American Honey was exploitative of a situation in a bad way, this movie exploits a story artfully for a clearer, more definite purpose. And so I can say X served that purpose. Like the changing of the Sienna Miller character serves that purpose and also fits organically into the story this movie is trying to tell.
I really like that, you know, by all, I mean, this is technically a biopic, but it's not, as you're saying, it's not really, this wouldn't be something you would be good to show in school. Like more about that internal conflict, which I like a lot. Like, you know, his many journeys to the Amazon, like we see brief snippets that say far more about his character than anything about what he was actually doing.
Yeah. And it's actually,
which I really like about the movie.
It's interesting, Bill, that you had brought up how easy they made it seem because it's true. Like I was kind of expecting this to be laborious and just like deadening, but instead it's like brisk. It's like the first trip that they take, they'd spend more time with to kind of set you up. But then after that, they just kind of give you like Robert Pattinson, who appears to like have like flesh rot around his nose, and you can kind of see the wear on them without having to go through the journey because you've been through it once and you sort of get it now.
Also, Angus McFadden might be my MVP for this movie.
Oh, God. He plays a wonderful bastard. He's great in that role. What a dick.
And we all know who Shackleton is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, just making sure.
It's funny because I was thinking about this movie, and we give a lot of credit and we spill a lot of ink over the people who went to the polls. I don't feel like I often hear about people who charted, like the Amazon region.
I wonder if it is. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that like people were there, and so it's harder to reconcile. Like,
sure.
The colonial interests of the time, because this whole movie starts off because they want to keep the rubber trade up.
Sure.
But, you know, Shackleton and going to the South Pole, it's like, what, you're going to ruffle the feathers of some penguins. It's like, it's a lot easier to say, like, oh, that was the spirit of exploration. There was nothing else they wanted. They weren't enslaving anyone. They weren't burning any cities to the ground. Anyway, Bill, you were going to say.
It's funny. It's funny because I made a Facebook post shortly after watching this movie, and one thing upon hindsight that I mentioned was that this is a film that kind of takes place in an era where areas were kind of unexplored by – I just put unexplored. And that couldn't be further from the truth. This area wasn't explored. It was inhabited, in fact. But for Western culture, for the white men, for the modern day man, it isn't. You know, it's still one of those things that still to this day, a lot of the Amazon is unexplored. There's several tribes down there that have no human contact.
No contact with outside civilization.
Yes.
They are themselves human. See? Here's the funny thing, Bill, to the point of what you're saying. People used to say, like, you know, this area has never been seen by white men. And it's like, yes, correct. But for some reason, just having that phrase white men in there, it sounds icky. So we started saying, these are completely unexplored, which, as you point out, is incorrect. Because if a native population exists there, it has indeed been explored. I feel like we don't have a good way of melding those two ideas together.
We do not.
You have to say really artless things like, you know, modern European civilizations have not made contact in that area.
Yeah. Even saying Western, they're from the West, and it's like, wait, I don't know. They're literally living in the West, and it's like, damn it, I can't figure out a way to artfully say that without just sounding like a buffoon.
Yeah.
They've never had human
contact outside of their immediate family and friends.
It is interesting though, because it is this kind of, you know, this is shortly before World War I, when this film is kind of taking place. There's just so much about it that just seems like, I don't know. It's funny because I watched this movie and I was expecting it really to kind of hone in on this idea that these areas were unexplored by modern man. And it seemed like that Fawcett became kind of obsessed with was an idea, not necessarily exploration. And I think that's interesting that an idea was what he was chasing, not necessarily the fruit of exploration, you know, not the desire of exploration, but just figuring out if this thing that he has heard or rumored is true or not. And the way they kind of set it up in the film is a little, it's a little funky. It's like he basically hears a whisper and he's like, sounds like an idea. Well, and then just runs with it. And for 2 hours you get that movie and you're like, wait, what?
Like, it's like he hears a whisper and then he sees a shadow and then he runs with it. Because when he first hears the native guide saying, like, you know, oh, there was a city, you know, it was gilded in gold and there were many roads and stuff and blah, blah, blah. He's like, okay, guys, the native guide has gone mad. He's babbling to himself like a child about some fantastic city. I think we're going to have to cut him loose. And and then he finds the pots and he's like, oh my God, is it possible that this guy who I thought was gripped by the jungle madness is telling the truth? It like has some reality. And I think that that's interesting. And that is my dog going bananas. And I don't know why.
Is that lightning?
Yeah.
Okay.
He seems to have stopped.
I don't know. This film has a lot of things kind of going for it. For me, it left me feeling a little hollow, mainly because I wish it had spent more time in the jungles, like Brian was saying. I was expecting it to spend more time there. I was expecting it to feel a little bit more dangerous. I was expecting it to feel a little bit more exploration-y. I think the highlights of this film are kind of some of the natives' interactions. And you know, the history behind the natives, I think, is so fascinating. And I wish this film really kind of explored it, because, you know, they do mention the conquistadors and the people that come over there. But if you realize kind of the history of it, it's so fascinating, because they basically saw these white people, these explorers, come over and either through enslaving them or just massacring them, or their disease that they brought over that just wiped out slews of these natives. You can imagine that when the natives see people on a boat going up and down the river, I can imagine them throwing spears too, because they'd be like, no, fuck you. You guys are terrible. Get away from me here. Yeah, you get the hell away from me. And I feel like there's so much of that is just kind of unexplored. You know, they don't ever really explain why there's tension between the natives and the explorers. Like, why do they not like them? Why do they not see them and like – you know, beyond the language, and it's interesting because the language barrier is kind of broken at this point as well. So, you know, Percy can kind of communicate, I guess, in Portuguese. I found that fascinating, the way that he took that upon himself to kind of learn some Portuguese, I guess, to the point where I don't know, these boat trips must have taken several years, I guess. And so he had some time to kill. And I guess he learned Portuguese on the way, or whatever language that they're speaking in the film. I imagine it's Portuguese, but
it might have been Spanish.
I'm not even sure.
I don't know.
I think the other thing about the scenes with the natives, and it reminded me a lot of Embrace the Serpent from last year, which was a movie that was like very much from the natives' perspective. So it is partly how much I liked getting a different view on that, but I guess I kind of had similar feelings to Bill about the interactions with the natives, in the sense that it's very plot based. All the interactions, you know, there's a lot of time spent in the jungle, but it's a lot of waiting, and that's evocative and interesting in its own way. But then when you get to the natives, it's just those scenes just felt oddly perfunctory to me. Like they were just waiting to get to the next scene. And I wanted to spend more time with actually understanding that. And I guess, again, that's,
I think it would be,
again, part of like the interesting tone, in the sense of he thinks he's respecting them more, but he's really just, you know, using them in his own way to, you know, find the next point on a map you should check out.
Yeah, he's not quite showing proper respect, and that's kind of the thing, is like he kind of thinks that he can just drop by like a friend sure. who crashes on your house during a road trip, and like in a way, like, yeah, he's not poking them, prodding them, asking a bunch of questions, and, you know, wandering in with guns to try to like take things from them, but he's not being particularly deferential either.
But those aspects kind of like disappear from like the third act, Brian, and I guess that's what especially just kind of bothers me.
The third act, when the final trip,
I would say around the time when he and the preparation period. I guess we're getting into spoilers.
Yeah. We're getting into third act stuff and stuff like that.
Sure.
So.
Yeah,
so let's,
no, you're right.
Let's talk about the final voyage by getting into spoilers. So this is spoilers for The Lost City of Z. I guess we should say before we do that, should people go see this? I say emphatic yes.
Yes.
I say yes.
Okay. So differing levels of yes from all of us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now, spoilers. So Michael Sindel, at what point do you feel that his interaction with the natives becomes perfunctory?
I would say every experience with the natives feels perfunctory. Perfunctory in the sense of it being entirely narrative-based. You know, when he first meets that narratives and – Natives.
You back down, sir. Back down. They are not just narrative devices. They are humans.
They kind of are narrative devices. That's okay. That's like kind of my point. I won't go quite that far. It's just like I think the prelude to meeting the natives, I think that scene where he puts up the – I believe he's holding a Bible and he has the flat – or the handkerchief that he's waving. Is that what it is, a handkerchief?
I don't know if it's a Bible. I'm pretty sure it's a handkerchief, yeah.
All right, regardless. Yeah. Like it's just – there is so much build up there. And I get that that's, as you said, Brian, that's the point. Like, it's like someone who you just decide to show up at somebody's place and be like, oh, I'm staying here tonight. Deal with it.
Yeah, because it's funny because for most of the movie, it's like, uh-oh, let's just get down and try to get through this. And he's like, no. Let's see if we can talk to these people. And it's a very foolhardy thing to do.
Yeah, ballsy as hell.
Yeah, because
he literally gets an arrow stuck inside of – I think it's a dictionary, but yeah, he gets an arrow stuck inside the book.
I'm going to say it's a journal.
Okay. There you go. Right. None of us agree on this.
But yeah, because at this point, he doesn't have any concept of like who these people are or what's going on. He's just like – what you know, it's again like if you wandered onto someone's property and they were like, get out, please leave, and you were just like – It's cool, man. I'm a friend. I'm okay. And then they like got more and more aggressive, and you finally just broke them down.
But that's then the thing for me, Brian, because so you don't spend time, and that stuff is like sly and funny. And then in the third act, it is much more straight ahead. Like obviously, there since we're in spoilers, we can talk about the ambiguity of what happens to them when they meet a cannibal, a tribe that is known as cannibals. But like that.
That's the third act.
I'm not saying that's the third act. I would say third act when he returns and starts squabbling with McFadden.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Murray. Okay, fine. So from there.
Man,
like
before we get to World War One. For anyone who's curious about the sweep of this movie. We're defining the third act, and we still have to get through World War One and then a whole other expedition. But yes.
Oh, shit. All right, fine. After World War One, after he seems to be blinded, but is not, in fact, blinded. Which, by the way, I thought the movie was going to end with that image of the fabric on the trench barbed wire, and I was going to be very angry. But it didn't. Anyway, okay, so around that time, I think the movie starts getting a lot more straight ahead, and I guess obviously we're going to argue about that last scene, because that last scene is striking, and there's a mystery and a grace to it, but it doesn't feel earned to me, because it feels like something out of a far more traditional film, just handled with far more craft and far more visually interestingly than what other directors would do. Like I just don't understand why the film kind of chooses to lose that subversive edge. Like it wants to be sincere at the end, and I understand that, but it's something about that just rings false to me, and rings to me as a way to do a grandiose ending without actually earning it.
So I guess I'm confused. To your mind, what would have kept up that subversive nature?
See, that's a good question. I'm not sure about the answer to that question.
The end, but in my eyes, is still pretty on point with all of that. I mean,
with whether he misinterpreted everything.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, it's almost more tragic because he can't get the drunkard friend who, like, was always down to go anymore. His other friend,
Pattinson, are you referring to?
So Arthur Manley, played by Edward Ashley, died in World War I.
Okay.
Costin, played by Robert Pattinson, refuses to go because he's like, I've got a wife and a child now.
Sure.
And
he's not a crazy person.
Fawcett's like, I had a wife and a child and another one on the way, and I still went. That was the first time. And Costin's like, yeah, I don't have faith that you're going to find what you're looking for. I believe that the city uh-huh. exists, but I think that what you're chasing is beyond that, and I don't know you're going to find it. And he goes. He goes anyway. He goes with his son.
Also, by the way, it's Costin, right? Yeah. Costin's probably like, don't worry, dude. You let me know if you find it. Then I'll know. like you send me a telegram. You let me know. Let me know if there's something to go look at. Yeah. I'm gonna be over here. and I think a lot of that is interesting because not only in real life does he take his son, who by the way was not an explorer, was ridiculously unprepared for that journey, that trip. Also, he brought his son's best friend as well.
I read about that,
to be like, hey, come on, like, yeah, let's go do this thing. And it's like, what is that?
It's further interesting in this movie because he even told his wife, like, you can't go, you haven't had the training. And then he takes his son, and the wife says, don't forget that he needs some training too. And he's like, oh yeah, training, he'll get some of that.
Yeah, it's on the train ride over while we wave at all the people yelling at us. Yeah,
because
that's when training happens.
He's not really an anthropologist. He's not really an explorer. He's just a man who sees something in the distance and needs to get to it. And it's it just so happens that he captures the imagination of some people.
I found his kind of uppityness about being an explorer just really interesting because I really wanted him in this film to suffer a little bit more at his own naivete.
Agreed.
like I really want, I mean, look, ultimately he maybe dies, most likely is killed by some of the natives. Thank you.
It's hard because in the movie they call them Indians.
Sure.
Which is feels even more incorrect than when we called Native Americans Indians. It's some
foot and mouth moments all over.
Yeah. I just really wanted him to kind of get his comeuppance in the film itself. In the film itself, it's kind of like,
it's,
I don't
kind
know,
of skips
it,
through
it,
things.
Why do you want him to get Why do you, what has he done to deserve comeuppance? Like, he's not.
But it doesn't feel like, I think Bill and I, even if we're coming at it in different ways, I think we both feel that, like, I just didn't totally feel like I went on a journey by the end. I feel I like the way this is, like, constructed, and I find it interesting, but I didn't really feel like I was on an emotional journey with this character. From moment to moment, it was interesting to me. But by the end, I was like, you guys didn't really earn this. I don't really know this person that much.
I find that fascinating because I felt like I went on a huge emotional journey with this character.
I mean, there's...
I unfortunately can't, like... I can't say anything about what it is because, like, I could rattle off, like, the script notes version of it, tell you, like, what instances happened. But I don't think that's going to change any minds. So
no,
He begins the movie just like, I don't have any decorations. I'm a lieutenant and I don't have any decorations and everything sucks. And there's a great line where someone said, like, he had the misfortune of like choosing the wrong ancestry, which is just the most British thing that anyone could ever say. And so he does this for
and then they walk off with their noses high and they're like, "Oh, let me go into this back room where we're going to have a fancy dinner."
For that one line of dialogue, they got a character actor from Barry Lyndon, by the way, for that one line.
I mean, well cast. I mean, that was a great delivery of that line. So, what I was going to say is, like, you know, the movie begins and he's hunting for that thing that will, like, resurrect his family name because his father apparently was drunk and a gambler. And he wants glory. And then towards the end, he doesn't. He just wants to find this thing. He's taken his ambition and turned it from the external trappings of rank and class to just this echo that he's been chasing for 20 years by the time we get to the end of this movie.
Right. Again, I think it has a mythic weight. It's just... It's something about not feeling like what the script is trying to reach for is just not reached on a physical level for me with this character's journey we see on screen.
Interesting.
Like, I think there's quite a bit here that you have to infer.
It's weird because there's a thin line between just like following the narrative and understanding what it's implying and then saying that someone has to infer something. And it's, I mean, it really is like there's just that harmonic emotional resonance. And if the movie has it, then you don't feel like you're inferring something. But if you don't reach that same pitch, then obviously you do just have to make the logic jump in your head to know what the movie wants you to feel.
I mean, this movie's got scope. It takes place over years and years.
Again, like there's a lot. You were delineating covered. The third act, and we still had like a good 10 years
I
to
know,
go.
I know.
It's pretty it's pretty amazing. What is it with movies that like have World War One? Like, there are very rarely any World War One movies, but there are lots of movies that just like take a pit stop in World War One.
Sunset Song last year did that.
War Horse is more specifically kind of about War Horse. War I, but it's really like about the fucking horse, you know?
yep.
Like, and when I was a kid, I was like obsessed with World War One, and I don't know why. I know that like the concept of trench warfare was like horrifying and like exciting in a terrible way. Like exciting in the way that only war can be exciting to a young man, like who has no concept of death but still has a concept of battle, which might be one of the more profound things that I've ever said. And like, I don't understand why something is inherently cinematic, and I don't think that there's ever going to be another war that can make you as anti-war as World War One, because like World War Two, you'll always have. You know, the moral justifications of it to fall back on. And that's, you know, you see a World War II movie and you see us liberate the camps and you're pro-war for that instant. But World War One is like just nonsense treaties and bullshit. And then horrible fighting and living conditions for nothing. And I just don't understand why World War One doesn't have more cinematic presentations. Because every time it pops up in a movie, it's very, very visually compelling.
The whole idea of World War One is it kind of echoes a lot of things now, in that there was a power vacuum because Britain was no longer the dominant force in Europe, and that's kind of what sparked all of this.
And that was the beginning of our American ascendance.
It was.
Something else that we had to pitch in.
Yeah,
this movie touches on the American explorers who were kind of like goaded on by stories of Percy Fawcett.
Yeah, found Machu Picchu and all the ancient civilizations there, and which again, once that happened, you would think that that Fawcett would no longer have to convince anybody. And, I'm trying to remember at what point in that timeline. I think it's when he's coming back from the second journey about to start World War One, and so he hasn't started the third journey yet, which in reality, I believe he took like 7 or 8 trips back and forth.
It was apparently a lot.
So and the book details that, because I was just like, wait, how many trips is he taking in this movie? Like, it seems to take a lot longer than I remember. And then that's detail,
because I thought 3 was a lot, and then I found out he took like somewhere between 5 and 7, and I was like, my god, it's insanity. It's interesting that, you know, like an American explorer, I don't remember who it was, proves him right, basically. Says, like, we found a giant city. It proves that civilization existed where we thought these people were just savages. And he's like, that's cool, but it's not Zed. So I'm going to keep going back because I need to find my city. And again, that's I think, you know, because if this were a film purely about a man who wanted to prove to the world that the natives in Amazonia, you know, were not wise beyond our reckoning, but like more civilized than we had assumed, you know, to whatever extent,
had a culture,
hearing that would have been enough, but it wasn't enough because it wasn't his city. He needed his city.
Yep.
That thing that he saw out in the forest. That's what he wanted. That fucking panther. Yeah. Not shown up.
He became obsessed with an idea that was just not something that he was ever going to be able to prove in his lifetime, and even to this day is still kind of this mythic idea that maybe isn't true, that maybe isn't real. Well,
what I think is the most interesting turn in this story, I'm not going to say in the story of Percy Fawcett, but in the Lost City of Z, is that he then becomes his own Zed. God damn it, I said Z again. He becomes Zed to apparently like 100 other people who go out and try to find him.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories of him.
So he's the Velvet Underground?
Yeah, definitely. what was I going to say? Yeah, so I mean, he goes out looking for the city. He's certain that it's there. And then he disappears with his son. And then hundreds of people go out and look for him. And I was reading today about like theories about what happened to him, which is always the most fun thing to do, you know, if you ever have like 2 hours that you can kill, is just find someone who disappeared and then look up theories on what happened to them. And like,
what's crazy about it, and I'm sure you were probably going to touch on this, but I would step on your toes just briefly. But what's crazy is that this is not something that's necessarily like, oh, it happened in the 50s and people stopped searching for him. No, they kept searching into the 70s, 80s, 90s. And the book, the 2009 book that came out that was based on that New Yorker article by David Gran, by the way, he looked for him.
Yeah.
So it's like with all this modern day technology, everything that we can, you know, bring to bear on the Amazon, even still, we still aren't 100% certain what's even happened to this man, or, you know, it's just so much is still a mystery about the Amazon and that area in general, that it's just like it's one of those chaseable dreams that it's just like, yeah, but for what reason? Like, to what end?
Like, he's gone, and at this point he's definitely not alive anymore, so why do people keep going? I mean, it's weird. And, you know, looking up today, there were like apparently 3 different sets of bones that people claimed were his, and none of them ended up being true. And you know, the one that this movie, you know, I wouldn't say it lands on it precisely, but it definitely kind of runs with it, is that he is perhaps taken in by this group of natives, and that is him finding his city, and he sends back the compass to the guy, and his wife delivers it, and she has her monologue about, you know, what her life's work has been, and that's when all of the times that we've seen her and her actions kind of snap into focus and really kind of, you know, underpin the entire narrative thesis of this film. Which, like I said, it's really great. It's a really classically designed and executed film in like the best, most
But that structure is pretty weird. It's not really like a classic structure. Like the way the story is told is pretty unusual.
Yeah, I would say it's the craftsmanship more than the narrative flow itself. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a movie that ends with a woman who's lost her husband and son
like,
giving a speech to an important man that, you know, sums up the ideas of the movie. And then in a shot that is absurd and shouldn't work, but that does.
It's a little unbelievable that he essentially did the same shot as the immigrant.
As the immigrant, yeah.
I think that it's... it's a similar shot, yes, but I think that this one outdoes the immigrant, which is...
Ooh,
shocking.
Nick Newman would throw rocks at you.
Did you say the immigrant would throw rocks at me?
No, Nick Newman.
No, I said Nick Newman.
I misheard that like crazy. Anyway, it's possible that he would. I think he has a lot of reasons to throw rocks at me already. But I think that I think that this ending is perhaps more powerful than The Immigrant. That's not to say The Immigrant's not powerful. I loved The Immigrant. But Nick Newman, I believe, and Danny King, I think, both had that as their number one film of the year. So it would not surprise me.
Definitely the ending. Yeah, I think Nick called it one of like the best endings in like 10 years of cinema or something like that.
I happen to think that
this
one is equally as good.
I didn't mention my own history with James Gray kind of at the beginning, but I do want to mention that I thoroughly enjoyed The Immigrant. I thought that was a fantastic film that was unfortunately buried by the Weinstein Company.
Yeah,
so.
the Weinsteins post Miramax have not been the best with getting their films out.
Worse than Netflix.
I was just about to say, funnily enough, The Immigrant is on Netflix. But yes, the Weinstein Company was the pre-Netflix Netflix in terms of burying really worthwhile films. Do we have any other final thoughts on this before we say goodbye?
That sequence in the hospital with Fawcett and his family is probably one of the like. You know, when this is more than likely nominated for an Oscar, I can see that sequence being one of the things that they kind of play to just kind of drum up some emotion out of people that have watched the film, because that moment, that entire sequence is really, really harrowing. And the whole fact that he's like, I won't be able to see my city. You're just like, wait, you got your family right in front of you. It's just like, that's what you're worried about? Ah, okay.
I love that scene as a conclusion, or I shouldn't say conclusion, but a continuation of his son, you know, being very angry at him. Mm-hmm. And as like a culmination of that hospital scene. I like that almost as much as his own monologue.
Which monologue?
Sorry, what Bill was referring to, where he's saying how he'll never be able to see the city, but his reunion with his son, where they finally realized that he could have died in that moment. Like, I thought that was a really beautiful moment.
I really liked that whole moment. Was great. The moment between him and his son when they're being prepared.
Yeah, I love that sequence.
Mm-hmm. That was brutal and really good. I found that the ambiguity of that whole end scene, well, that climactic scene for them in the jungle, was pretty fantastic, because
I agree.
You know, you it's one of the few times that we get subtitles that aren't meant to be understood by Fawcett himself.
Sure.
And you know, it's like, you know, they're not the tribe that we'd hate. It's like, yeah, but they're not one of us either. It's like, well, let us help their spirits find a place. And that could either be like,
it's like, what the hell does that mean?
Into our place, like, let's give him a home here, or it could be, let's set him free through murder.
Yep.
I don't think I've really mentioned this, but Sienna Miller, great in this movie. Charlie Hunnam, who knew? Great actor in this movie. I feel like this is the most I've enjoyed him, and it turned me from, ugh, Charlie Hunnam to, oh, Charlie Hunnam. Which is a good pivot. I'll also say production designer.
I, I,
Jean-Vincent Puzos, who did Amour and Childhood of a Leader.
Hmm.
Great work.
Oh, we also Childhood. Have, Childhood yeah. of a Leader.
Another oh, Rob
I
Pattinson
like that
joint.
Movie.
I think.
Yep.
Did
yes,
we
sir.
All like Childhood of a Leader when we talked about it? I feel like we did.
I have not seen it.
That was Amanda.
Amanda.
That was Amanda.
Here. Yeah.
I think that's on Netflix, actually.
It is, yes. Cinematographer is Darius
Conji.
Yeah. Also fantastic. Done a lot of great stuff.
I believe they shot this film. They shot this film in 35 millimeter. And one of the quirky moments that James Gray was actually recanting.
Recanting is when you take back.
Telling.
Okay.
Telling. Okay. I'll go with telling. I know that word better.
Well done.
Anyways, he was telling the story about how oppressive the shooting in the jungle was. I can't remember if he actually shot in the Amazon or not, but I believe they shot in a jungle for certain, more than likely in the Amazon. And he was mentioning how by the end of the shoot, they were shooting on these old lenses and in with these old, cameras. And they ruined one of the lenses when they found out that a plant was growing inside of it.
What? That's awesome.
Yeah. And he was just like, yeah, that's kind of my story of the 4 months I spent down in the jungle that – Nothing quite went right. It was hell. And
it was
I have a
by
plant.
Piranhas.
Yeah. One of my lenses has a plant inside of it now, thanks to the Amazon.
And then the final shout out I wanted to give was Christopher Spellman, who was the composer. Because I found that the music was a very influential part of this movie and my enjoyment.
It reminded me a lot of Upstream at times, in the sense that it's just like a hum at certain, you know, like a
Upstream
atmospheric hum. Upstream color.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, I've never heard of Upstream. Yeah, Upstream color. That is a good point. I'm going to have to insist that we use full movie titles on first statement of them. So that's about that, I think. Let us be off then. Today's episode, as always, was brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming cinema that has curators that choose a new film each day for you to enjoy. You have 30 days with that film before it disappears out into the ether. There is... I am choosing to say this just because I don't know if I'm going to get through it. Theodoros Angelopoulos... Angelopoulos. Yeah, no, I think I got it. Theodoros Angelopoulos, Greek auteur and one of the last directors who truly had monumental visions for the grandeur of motion pictures. And there are two playing currently on Mubi, Ulysses' Gaze and Landscape in the Mist. So if you'd like to take a look at those and you don't want to have to pay for it right away, you can go to mubi.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial of Mubi. And, yeah, you should get on that. So, that is it for today. This week we'll be recording a roundtable. We don't currently have any topics picked out for that, but I'm sure that they will come to us soon enough. Maybe something about, like, cinematic threats that we don't see enough of anymore. Piranhas, quicksand, tornadoes. Anyway, we'll figure it out, and you can look for what we're going to do on Twitter, and you can respond with whatever question that we ask. Until then, gentlemen, let's tell fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, and you can read my stuff at the Film Stage and Pace Magazine.
All right, excellent. Now, Bill Graham.
You can find me looking up Google image searches of Sienna Miller, trying to figure out what she actually looks like so I can find her in the next film she stars in.
That almost got weird.
On Twitter.
I was about to say that was real creepy for a second.
Okay. I had to finish, guys. I had to finish.
Go for it.
I can't hear myself over the music. You can find me
I think we're actually just losing Bill.
Do we lose?
All right. Bill can be found at Cable BFG and on the film stage where I can be found as well. And you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan and my personal site, dearfilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us and tune in next time. I try to cross to the opposite side so I can finally find what I've been looking for in the middle of the night. I go walking in my sleep through the valley of fear to a river so deep. I'm in search of something. Taken out of my soul. Bill?